You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
It is Tuesday, June 14th, 2016. My name is Sam Steeter. The four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live. Steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America. Downtown Brooklyn, USA. I wish it was January. 2024.
And neither of them is president anymore? No more Trump.
On the program today, Matthias Matisse on the future of the euro, specifically Brexit, to Brexit or not Brexit. Also on the program today, more information slowly dribs out of the bizarre case of this mass shooter who killed 50 people in a gay nightclub. Meanwhile, on the policy front, net neutrality passes a big court test. The internet can be legally classified as a utility that's going to have incredible implications beyond just net neutrality. Meanwhile, Hillary Clinton wants a broader terror watch list. And Donald Trump wants to put this country under a dome. Presumably clear, but one with a ability to determine the ancestry of its participants and suck them out of the dome via some type of vacuum mechanism.
Also fantastic.
Meanwhile, Puerto Rico debt crisis now in the hands of the feds. Their attempt to get wiggle room in a federal court fails, or I should say at the Supreme Court fails. Russian hackers have stolen Trump opposition data from DNC servers. Bizarre. There's been some weird implications that Trump and the Russians, they could also just, yes, be watching their TV. And rest in peace to Mishu, the guy who played Alf, and when I was a kid, was known as the world's smallest man. That was, I mean, this was, you know, this is, of course, before the internet and all you kids out there with your fancy means in which to entertain yourselves. But back when I was a small child, all we had were books written on the side of caves. And
Alf.
Well, Alf came a little later. And there's, I think anybody my age remembers the picture of Mishu and standing next to the world's tallest man. This is when, like, the Guinness Book of World Records was, like, the, like, just a bizarre, when that book came out, just that concept of a book that was not, like, narrative, just, like, had short little stories, was just, like, whoa. And then there was this picture of, like, the world's tallest man. I know when I turn on the IM machine, a lot of people are going to IM and remember that. And I think Mishu was in, like, a Barnum and Bailey circus for a short period of time. But apparently he played Alf, and he died after an extended illness. And apparently there's a GoFundMe page to deal with his funeral costs because he had been basically just impoverished by a medical condition. He had a stroke, I guess. So, not a typical story for us, but uplifting in this day and age. There's all sorts of information coming out about this killer, Omar Mateen. He was interviewed on at least two occasions by the FBI, tipped off by people in his social circle or professional circle, as it were, co-workers, who said that he was going around saying stuff like he was a member of Al-Qaeda, that he was a member of ISIS. Understand that those are two, and Hezbollah. Understand that these are groups that would not allow you to be a member of all three.
And there's no joint packages.
No. ISIS and Al-Qaeda, sworn enemies. Al-Qaeda and Hezbollah, also sworn enemies. ISIS and Hezbollah, actively fighting each other. But this is a guy who was going around saying that, was reported to the FBI. The FBI sat down with him on multiple occasions. And his name came up in sort of tangentially in other investigations. It is now reported that his former wife said that she thought that he was bipolar. She thought that he might be gay. Thought he was definitely dealing with serious mental issues. Co-workers said the same thing. He became obsessed with some of the co-workers, would text them constantly, and then sort of go back and forth between, like, you're a horrible person, you should die, and then, hey, sorry, I said that stuff before. I mean, it sounds like sort of textbook serious emotional and mental issues that were being obviously untreated. His current wife now has just started speaking to the FBI, and apparently she says that she had taken him to that club on prior occasions and had tried to talk him out of doing something violent. Apparently he had been to this club for years. He had been using gay apps. Friends of his from college assumed that he was gay. And there seems to be, to the extent that he was radicalized, the depth of that radicalization seems to be somewhere along the line of someone who is a fanatic InfoWars fan. He saw this stuff online. Apparently, he did go to Saudi Arabia for pilgrimage in 2011 and 2012. But it's really unclear. I mean, what is clear at this point, and this could change, that there was no operational ties with any group, terrorist or otherwise. That this was a guy who was qualified to buy these weapons because he had a pulse, essentially. And then decided one night, apparently after drinking at the club and then came back, that he was going to shoot the place up. So, I mean, I guess if this was, I don't even know. Like, you know, the idea that the but for here is Islam, I suppose you could call this radical Islam, but I don't know to what ends. I mean, it's quite clear that there is only one way to have even remotely prohibited this. Maybe there's two ways. One is if you ever have an interview with the FBI, then you should not be able to get a gun. Now, that to me seems problematic for a number of reasons. In fact, I think you'd have a bigger constitutional problem, regardless of what the Constitution says about owning a gun. I think you'd have a bigger constitutional problem by disqualifying someone by virtue of being interviewed by the FBI for anything, for a driver's license, for that matter. So really, your options are to ban guns. I don't know if that's a viable option at this point, but I mean, the fact of the matter is, this is the type of society we live in, where if there is someone out there who is, I mean, he obviously like was fighting some demons inside him, and they were centered around his inability to accept the fact that he may be gay. I don't know. I mean, we don't have a clear picture quite yet. But the idea that this was sort of the but-for here was ISIS videos. Even that tenuous of a connection seems to be dubious. That, of course, doesn't stop people from promoting that because it fits with a certain narrative. As if, even if he was directly inspired by these lunatics in ISIS, or even if he was the guns that he got were secured for him by ISIS, and that he was put in this country not as a citizen, but dropped in some secret tunnel by ISIS, as if this would implicate Islam, is ridiculous. But of course, none of those things happened. None of those things happened. So really, there's only one way to really deal with this problem, and that is to mitigate it. You can't stop a crazy person who is from going around and harming themselves or other people, but you can mitigate the damage they can do to themselves or other people to some extent. You can't stop somebody from jumping in front of a subway train. And in certain instances, you can't stop somebody from pushing other people into a subway train. But it's a lot easier to stop someone from pushing 10 people into a subway train, in front of a subway train, than it is one. And a lot easier, in fact, almost impossible to imagine that someone could push 50 people in front of a subway train. Not so hard to imagine that someone could go down into a subway station and shoot 50 people if they have a weapon that fires 45 bullets in a matter of seconds. All right, we got to take a break. When we come back, we're going to change gears here and talk about the potentially impending Brexit with Matthias Matisse. He is a professor from Johns Hopkins University. We'll be right back after this. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. Matthias Matisse, he is the Assistant Professor of International Political Economy at Johns Hopkins University, co-editor with Mark Blythe of the book The Future of the Euro, published by Oxford University back in April of 2015. Welcome to the program, Matthias.
It's a pleasure to be on it.
So let me ask you this. Was when you edited that book in terms of the future of the euro, at that time, were you anticipating the potential for a a British exit?
Well, we've been anticipating for a few years. The book itself was more focused on the future of the euro and the eurozone. We did make a prediction at the last chapter that at some point Britain would have to choose of either joining the euro and the European Union as a full-fledged member or having to leave it altogether. But we didn't think that this choice was going to come so soon.
So, all right, let's go back and for the moment, indulge us and assume that that Donald Trump is listening to the program. And okay. So let's get very remedial here so that he has an understanding of the European Union. The European Union developed over, multiple stages and over decades in terms of just how unified it became. Just give us a brief history of the European Union and then the union, the economic union.
Yeah. So I think what's important to note is that one of the first people to call for a United States of Europe after World War II was Winston Churchill. What people get confused by is that what Winston Churchill had in mind is a United States of Europe without Britain. He saw Britain as the kind of center of the Commonwealth. He saw the United States as a major power. He saw the Soviet Union as a major power. And so he did think, you know, Europe is where the trouble comes from. The kind of sworn enemies, France and Germany, fighting each other. So that needed to be solved. But Britain always saw itself as out of it. So the European Union then started really in 1950 with Schuman, who called for a European coal and steel community, thinking that coal and steel are really important for making war. If France and Germany jointly produce this, then they'll never go to war again. From that, very quickly came the Declaration of Messina in the mid-50s, and that started the European Economic Community in 1958, January 1st. And Britain, again, was not part of this because, you know, they thought of themselves as a world empire, right, as a great, a much bigger player than France or at the time Western Germany. And so what happened, of course, is in the 50s and the 60s, continental Europe was very successful. They were growing very fast, lower unemployment, and Britain looked like it was in relative decline vis-a-vis the rest of Europe. So this was very much a common market, right? It didn't have political ambitions. The idea of a defense community was killed in 1954. But so it's in the 60s that Britain started then to apply twice to join this European Economic Community to reverse what they perceived as their economic decline. But that was vetoed twice by Charles de Gaulle, who saw the British as a kind of American Trojan horse, didn't trust them, and in 63 and 67 it was vetoed. Of course, de Gaulle went out of office after the Paris 68 spring. He didn't last very long after, and then Britain successfully applied in the early 70s under Ted Heath, the conservative prime minister, and joined in 73. That was controversial already at the time, and it's interesting for today's story that Labour came to power in 74, and they were against the common market. They saw it as a free market neoliberal project they didn't want to be part of. So there was a referendum in 75 where they voted 2-1 to stay in.
All right, so give us a sense, though, in 74, like what does that mean, that they're part of the common market there? I mean, what are the actual sort of practical implications for that?
Yes, so what practically it means is the four freedoms, right? So for an American audience, imagine if NAFTA, Mexico, Canada, and the United States, were to be a common market. That would not just mean free trade of goods, but also free trade of services, free flows of capital, and free movement of labor.
Right.
So that would mean that every single Mexican tomorrow could decide, I want to work in the United States. They cross the border, they arrive, and they apply for jobs. So that is what it meant when Britain joined, right? Of course, at the time, Britain was the sick man of Europe. Europe is growing very fast. So they felt that they were solving their own domestic economic problems by joining this dynamically growing European market. But that's what it meant. It meant free flow of capital, labor, goods, and services.
Okay, so in 74, the Labour Party believes that this is a neoliberal project. And why would they be suspicious of this? Like, you know, for instance, I know that in this country, the perspective on trade that is actual trade, as opposed to, let's, you know, I don't want to confuse it too much with things like the TPP, which I think a lot of people perceive as just sort of more of like a a regulatory codification and sort of a ceiling on what each country can do in terms of regulations. But one of the issues is the fact that capital can traverse boundaries, but labor cannot, and so that gives them a distinct advantage. What was labor skeptical about in terms of being part of the common market? Was it a function of wages in Britain versus continental Europe?
No, absolutely. I mean, I think in many ways the fears of TPP and especially TPP that the left has with these free trade agreements were very similar of the Labour Party in 1974. So I have to say the Labour Party was split, right? But just as the Conservative Party today is split on Europe. The elites were very much in favor of this, of joining Europe. The kind of the grassroots were against, and they were against for a typical kind of race to the bottom argument, right? Is that this would erode labor standards, it would erode environmental standards, regulatory standards. And so they thought that economics would trump political choices that Britain had made since World War II for a welfare state, for all these kind of labor protections that they had. So it was the Conservative Party at the time, under Margaret Thatcher's very young leadership, she had just taken over in early 1975, that heavily campaigned in favor of staying in the European Economic Community, as it was known at the time. And also, what's interesting is that Margaret Thatcher, who became such a big critic of the European project, at the time said we need to fight what she called this kind of British-English parochialism, right? This kind of we can do this on our own. We need to open ourselves up, embrace globalization, embrace Europe, embrace growth and markets and so on. And so that was actually one quite resoundingly with a 2-1 vote, which kind of put the Europe question to bed for, you know, at least 40 years.
And so they're in the common market. And then what's the fallout? I mean, so I would imagine from 75 or so on, you can get a good measure as to what the implications are. And that takes us up to, I guess, the early 90s when Europe adopts a common currency.
Yeah. So excellent point. So the first 5-6 years, of course, the world economy is kind of in turmoil, and it's very hard to kind of see what the effect of Europe is. But there's a big summit before we get to Maastricht and the euro is in 1984 in Fontainebleau in France, where Thatcher famously had this argument that she wanted her money back, right? The idea was that because Britain has such little agriculture, they actually didn't get much money out of Europe, but they paid in a lot in Europe. So then she negotiated her famous rebate, that Britain would get a significant amount of money back that they got. And that exists up until today. What really started the Eurosceptic phase in Britain is Margaret Thatcher kind of constant railing against Europe being perceived as this super state project, right, as somehow eroding British sovereignty. And this started with her own chancellor shadowing the Deutschmark at the time to keep inflation down in Britain. And she was against this. And so she was pushed out over Europe when her foreign secretary, Geoffrey Howe, talked about a conflict of loyalty. His loyalty was to his country and to Thatcher, but he felt that Thatcher was becoming so prejudiced against Europe that she was undermining British national interests. So Thatcher gets thrown out in 1990, gets replaced by John Major, who then immediately has to negotiate Maastricht. Maastricht is important because it created the euro, it created so many more, it created the European Union the way we know it today. And so he negotiated these opt-outs out of Maastricht. But at the time, many British conservatives already felt that that was too much, Maastricht, with it, even with the opt-outs of the euro he negotiated. And that was the birth of the UK Independence Party that started in 1992, that today has become so powerful and such a big push to actually leave the European Union.
Ah, that's okay. So that's where UKIP gets its start. Is
yes, that's where they were born.
This concern that Britain, I guess, sovereignty and unique culture, I guess, right? I'm just trying to put it in sort of like Pat Buchanan terms in this country.
Absolutely. And immigration. And that became a very important because there is no check on immigration from within the European Union, right? And this really became a problem when the EU enlarged to the East and Central Europe when 10 countries joined. And then, you know, there's no cap you can put on how many Poles, how many Romanians can join Britain in the British labor market. And that's really the main point that the UK Independence Party, UKIP, has been driving home.
All right, so give us a sense of, like, I would just run it down almost as a checklist, if you could, as to what things at this juncture Britain participates in within the context of the European Union and market and economic union, because they don't share a currency. And so how does that change the dynamic, you know, as to where Britain has been relative to the EU? Because how did it impact, let's say, the financial crisis? Because they had more sovereignty, or I guess more control, autonomy over their own currency.
Yeah. I have always argued that Britain has its cake and eats it too, right? So when it comes to Europe, they are part of all the good stuff and they're not part of all the bad stuff. So it's almost like being in a marriage, right? Where you have all the benefits but none of the responsibilities, in a way. So they're not part of the common currency, which means that they can have their own monetary policy. They've done quantitative easing, which has been very good for the British economy, and they've been able to do it much earlier. Right? If they had been part of the euro, they would have had to wait until January 2015 when Mario Draghi finally felt comfortable to do all-out QE. So that's helped the British economy because it's lowered the value of the pound early on after the Lehman Brothers failure and the global financial crisis, and it's cushioned somewhat the austerity measures that they've done. So they've been able to do their own fiscal policy. They've chosen to do austerity. It wasn't imposed on them, right? They voted for it. The Conservative Party instituted it. But the Bank of England has been able to offset some of the most negative effects of this policy. When it comes to the refugee crisis, and that's, I think, the big other issue that we've seen in the last 2 years, they're not part of the Schengen passport-free zone, right? They have their own control of their borders when it comes to non-EU citizens. So Syrians, Turks, Afghans, Iraqis, right? People from North or Sub-Saharan Africa or North Africa, they fully control who comes in to Britain. What they cannot control is EU citizens themselves. Right? They have free access to the British market. But of course, they remain part of everything else that Europe does, but it also gives them great leverage, right? I mean, when it comes to global trade negotiations, being part of a market of 500 million rich consumers, the European Union, gives them much more leverage when they're negotiating with India, China, or say the United States with the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, TTIP, which is going on right now. So there's a lot they would stand to lose from leaving the European Union, but because they would lose that leverage of being part of such a big common market.
How much, in the context of negotiating trade deals, I mean, how much does, and I have no sense of this, but I mean, how often is it that an individual country becomes a backdoor, essentially, to the EU market? In other words, you know, I don't even know what an example of this would be necessarily, but I'm going to negotiate unilaterally with Britain as a way of getting my goods into one part of the EU, and then it spreads throughout. From there, I can go throughout the EU, or is that not allowed under the context of the EU as it stands now?
Yeah, so there's two things here, right? So if you are, let's say, a U.S. company, and you want to export stuff to the United to the European market, then you have to pay whatever the common external tariff is. So there's no advantage there of going through Britain or going through Denmark or going through Germany, because that external tariff or the external trade policy will be the same. What you can do, and that's the other side of the kind of international economic picture, is as a firm you can invest directly in the UK. Let's say you find the UK an attractive destination because they have an educated labor force that speaks English, their corporate taxation is not that high, their regulatory barriers for setting up a new business aren't that high either. And so many banks have set up shop in London because the regulation there is easier. That way they have access, as banks, as big banks, to the whole European market. Many other firms have set up their headquarters in London or anywhere in the UK because, again, from there on, if they produce stuff in the UK, they can export them for free, I mean, for tariff-free into the European market, right? So that is something that Britain would lose if they were to leave the European Union.
All right, and just going back, one more historical question until we sort of look forward a little bit more. But how close have the Brits been to joining the euro in terms of adopting the currency? I mean, was there ever a time where that was going to happen or looked like it might happen?
Yeah, I think that the experience of 92 is really important for the British elites and the British economy. So when they were basically pegging their currency, the pound sterling, to the Deutschmark, there was kind of this accident of history that the moment they decided to directly link their monetary fate with the German fate is at the time of German reunification. So what Germany did at the time to pay for reunification was borrow a lot of money. They raised interest rates at the time that Britain was about to slide into a recession. And then people like George Soros and other financial investors saw that this was unsustainable, and they basically bet against the pound and judged that the pound would leave the European exchange rate mechanism because it was unsustainable, right? Britain wasn't going to raise interest rates at the time that unemployment was going up because it was going to kill their economy. So in 92, on Black Wednesday, which was in September 16, 1992, Britain had to leave this European exchange rate mechanism, and the pound lost a tremendous amount of value. So that was a traumatic experience for the conservatives, the major government that was in power at the time. But also, it allowed them to recover very quickly from that recession afterwards, right? So since then, Labour came to power with Blair and Brown. I think Blair was much more Euro-enthusiastic than Gordon Brown was. So Gordon Brown devised these five tests, economic tests, to say, if we pass these tests, we will join the Eurozone and the Euro. But they were designed in a way to almost fail, right? And I think ever since the Euro crisis started in the spring of 2010 with the, you know, Greek bankruptcy, you know, teetering on bankruptcy, they felt very much happy that they never joined, right? And now they see the advantages of having your own monetary policy, your own currency, and so on, and they feel that the rest of Europe is very much caged in what they can do economically.
I mean, that's true, though, isn't it? I mean, or what's your opinion on that? I mean,
No, I absolutely agree. I mean, I do think that for very small countries, like, I mean, I grew up in Belgium and so on, right? I mean, a country like Belgium, it's a bit of an illusion to have your own monetary policy because capital will flow out or flow in very fast, right? But bigger countries like France, like Germany, like Italy, like Britain, they have a big enough internal market. They have, you know, the capacity to have and tailor their own monetary policy towards the needs of their own electorates, right? And don't forget, as long as we have nation states and democratic legitimacy lies with capital cities and not with Brussels, you still expect your national economic elites to respond to your national economic needs. Right. And Britain can do that a lot more than, let's say, France or Italy today, that kind of have to dance to the tune of German preferences when it comes to monetary policy.
So, all right. So give us a sense of, I mean, it sounds like from your perspective, Great Britain has sort of the best of both worlds at this point.
Right now. And, yeah, exactly.
And to leave would be sort of sacrificing a huge advantage that they have in that they still have this mobility or sovereignty to act in the way that they want to act in terms of their monetary policy. But they get all these other benefits in terms of free flow of all different types of things. Unless, yep, of course, I guess you are worried about the intrinsically British nature of Britain, I guess. I'm trying to put that in as Pat Buchanan-y or Donald, yeah, Trumpian terms as possible, right? Make Great Britain great again. Give us a perspective of what does happen. What do you imagine will happen to Great Britain in the event that they leave, they end their association with the EU? And what happens to the EU?
Yeah, these are very big topics, right? I mean, so there's a kind of an immediate impact, and then there's a kind of medium to long-term impact. I think what will happen to Great Britain is that this will create a tremendous amount of uncertainty for businesses for the next couple of years. So I think investment will collapse, in new investment, and this will have a big impact on the British pound, right? So the pound will weaken. A lot of money will flow out because that will be the immediate panic. And I think they will lose, I mean, they will gain some sovereignty, right? I mean, the Brexiteers, the Brexit campaign, isn't completely wrong about this. They will be able to control who enters their borders, right? When it comes to French or Germans or Eastern Europeans, right? And so that
right,
is
they can,
now the main...
That's the, they can keep a Great Britain great again type of... There's a better slogan in there somewhere, but...
But what is interesting about Britain is that the EU immigration they've seen, I mean, these are not just unemployed people, poor people from Eastern Europe that are coming in, right? I mean, they have 500,000 French working in London, making a lot of money, paying a lot of taxes, right? Mm. I mean, London is a global metropolitan city that does very well thanks to all this immigration. So immigration has been a net positive from the EU for them.
Would that necessarily end, though? I mean, in other words, now it just simply becomes Great Britain then gets the opportunity to decide in this event, like, we're only going to take the rich French people, and we're not going to take any of these poor Eastern European people. I mean, that's theoretically right. That's what UKIP is telling themselves, right?
That, absolutely. Okay. Absolutely. And they could then issue some sort of green card for the existing people that are there, right? I mean, they've made it very clear that they're not going to kick anybody out. They're not going to kick out, Polish citizens or Romanian citizens that have jobs. They're just not going to take any more. So that is going to be an immediate impact. I think when it comes to the European project, and I think the broader West, this is a tremendous setback for this ongoing process of European integration, right? I mean, many people have hailed the European Union as kind of the most imaginative act of statesmanship in international relations post-World War II. And in many ways, it's been tremendously successful in stopping war and stopping conflict, in creating prosperity. Are there problems with the way Maastricht set up the euro? Sure. But are these problems that can be solved? Absolutely, right? I mean, a little more flexibility, giving back a little more sovereignty on economic decisions and things like migration. I mean, this is something that Europe could do as well, right? I mean, to me, Britain is a great voice for more reasonable policies when it comes to economics especially. And so losing that for Europe will be important. Also, it will show that the process is not irreversible, right? That it actually is reversible, that it could have a ripple effect to other countries that will say, well, Britain renegotiated its membership. We want to renegotiate as well. Maybe, you know, the Czechs want to leave. Maybe the Dutch want to renegotiate certain things because they're very close to the British. And here I think Europe is very divided, right? The French very much want to punish the British and show that if you leave, this is the worst idea possible. The Germans are more like, well, you know, the markets will take care of this already. We need good relationships with Britain anyway, right? I mean, they're not going to magically drift off and join Massachusetts, right? I mean, they're still going to be there. It's still going to be a big market. There's still going to be a lot of people that work there. But it will be, I think, a big, who is cheering for Brexit? People like Vladimir Putin, right? Who want to see a weaker Europe and less cohesive Europe. And I think there, the consequences are much more serious.
Help us understand what some of these terms mean in a more sort of like tangible, practical way. So, I mean, in other words, when we say, I mean, I think like in terms of, I think people understand on some level, you know, what the implications of more sovereignty, not just immigration, but, you know, like a place like Greece, right? I mean, they were dictated terms. They have no control over their currency. They were dictated terms essentially by Germany, which had, depending on the narrative that you understand, had sort of put them in this position by willing to make them very bad loans. I mean, it's almost like you can see an analogy in terms of what's happened to people whose houses have been foreclosed when they were put into loans that they couldn't handle so that somebody else could make fees. But when we talk about like the benefits and that this is an imaginative policy and that Putin wants them weaker, I mean, aside from the fact that theoretically, right, this is preventing war on some level, right? Because mm-hmm. I guess there's a scenario where one could imagine if Greece goes belly up, and I guess maybe Italy or Spain do. I mean, who knows what different, and Germany's mad because they're not getting their money. I mean, who knows how that plays out? But give us a sense of what these things mean in a sort of more tangible way, if you can.
Yeah. So, I mean, here, I couldn't agree more with you when it comes to certain decisions of sovereignty, right? That Britain will control. So the main achievement of the European Union has been that it's avoided conflict between European Union members, right? I mean, we still have to deal with outside powers. But so, for example, what the European Union has made possible is something like the Iran deal, right? Where here you had Britain, France, and Germany coordinating with the United States on this directly. The European Union, I mean, Britain leaving the EU doesn't stop this being possible, right? I mean, Britain is still going to be a member of NATO, just like Canada is a member of NATO, and just like Turkey is a member of NATO and not a member of the European Union. I mean, we have examples like this, like Norway, for example, is a member of NATO but not a member of the EU. So from a security point of view, it will not have a big impact. But I think what the Americans have wanted to see for a long time now is for a more cohesive European common and defense policy that, you know, things that happen on our borders, that Europe can take care of this. And this is something that you very much feel in this election in the United States, right? Is that the tendency is, and this is not just Donald Trump, but that President Obama as well has said this, that they want the Europeans to do more. Now, if you start to dividing, if Britain leaves the EU and they stop coordinating as closely as they are with the rest of Europe, this becomes a lot harder to do, right? And so there are real tangible consequences of this also, because then it'll be easier for Russia to kind of divide Europe internally, right? They will make a deal with Germany, and this will go against the interest of Eastern Europe, for example. So there is a kind of sense that what you get is a breakdown of European solidarity. If Britain goes it alone, then what's to stop other countries from saying, okay, I want a Europe, as they say, a la carte, right? I want to pick and choose the things about Europe that I like. And then you lose the momentum towards a much more kind of cohesive bloc.
So you could have certain countries saying, like, we want a waiver on our agricultural policy. We want a waiver on our energy policy. And then so whether it's anything ranging from trying to build a sanctions regime or trying to isolate Russia in terms of its desire to expand, if it has one, you can't use economic tools in the same way that you could have if everybody's on the same page and sort of agreeing to, like, eat their own specific interests on some level.
Absolutely. And so you get a kind of, yeah, it's really a breakdown of solidarity that's worrisome, right? Because then you kind of get this nasty side. I mean, nationalism doesn't have to be a bad thing, right? It could be a positive thing. It could be like cohesive units that are, you know, proud of their heritage and their culture and so on, as long as they're open to the world and they want to receive, you know, just like the United States, right? They want to receive new immigrants and people come. But it does get you to the nasty side of nationalism, which isn't kind of us versus them, as long as we prosper and we make our separate deals. And that's really problematic, I think, for Europe. That's, you know, shrinking compared to a growing world economy with big players like India, China, the U.S., you know, Russia, is that it allows the Europeans will allow themselves to be divided again and be ruled over.
Right. I mean, I guess it's just, I mean, there's a standard dynamic that a certain amount of parochialism, it starts to cut against everybody's interest. I mean, we see it in the context of this when we talk about, like, let's close some military bases in this country. And everybody generally says yes until it becomes the base in their district that needs to close.
Exactly.
And then everybody's not so much.
Yeah, and if you look at, I mean, so many problems now, think of terrorism, think of, you know, refugees, think of climate change. I mean, these are things that genuinely need regional or global solutions.
Right.
The idea that you can go it alone is a very naive one, that you can close yourself off from the rest of the world. And what's interesting is that Britain still seems to think that somehow on their own, they will be able to negotiate trade deals much more easily. And I think that's something that President Obama on his visit to the UK has made very clear. It's like, well, in the end, Britain is a small market, 60 million people. They will be at the back of the line, he said. And I think that's something that they will come to regret. What worries me is that clearly this is a kind of interest versus passions debate, right? And I'm worried that the passions are going to win out over kind of more rational material interests, and that the next day, the day after a Brexit vote, and now it looks, I mean, the odds of the bookies are at 43% now. I mean, it's almost 50-50. That's too close for comfort, right? And that the next day they will be stuck with a process they've set in motion that they then cannot get out anymore. Because Europe has made it very clear, you vote to leave, the next day, you know, we start Article 50 of the Lisbon Treaty, which means the procedure to leave the European Union. And then this issue has been settled for a generation, right? And it does mean that the next parliament cannot say, oh, we want to join again. It's going to, and that's what worries me. Like one day of where turnout could be low, or maybe Britain, the English football team loses in their next game against Wales and they're all pissed off or something like that, right? It's too much. That's why we have representative democracy of people in parliament who know this material very well and make these decisions for us, than just a one-off thing that at the time may feel like we're taking sovereignty back, but could have consequences that really, and they were always, as always, hurt the poor the most, right? Because there's going to be a recession, and this is something that's not going to affect the elites as much as it will the bottom of the income scale.
Interesting. Matthias, Matthijs, thank you so much for your time today. Really appreciate it. And I guess we'll know within 10 days or so. Thank you so much for your time today. Really interesting stuff. And
pleasure. This was a lot of fun.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
There you have it, folks. I don't know. I imagine during the fun half, we'll hear some of our British listeners who may have a different perspective on it. I don't know. Sounds to me it's like Britain firsters.
Britain firsters.
Make great Britain great again. I mean, that's almost too good of a slogan.
What do you think? I sent you a very hacky one.
Let's see what. Where is yours? Wait a second. Make Her Majesty reign again. That's okay.
You got to make it Euros. You got to make it UK specific, though.
I know, but
UK is not. Yeah, I told you it was hacky, but we got to move in a different direction.
Well, I don't even know if that's hacky. I just think it's just not great. I'm just saying I would vote. It's not hacky. I mean, it's not hacky. It's clever. It's clever. Make Her Majesty reign again. I'm just saying that.
Yeah, it's like a 6 out of 10.
But make Great Britain great again. I mean, that's it's too good. It's almost too good.
Well, it's just a pudding. Yeah, I mean, I guess.
But really, I guess what it is make Great Britain Britain again.
I think we found it.
Right?
I think we found it.
It's already
I
got
think
the great.
We found it.
Oh,
let
man.
America be America again. Let Britain be Britain again. They have such an amazing deal from the EU. It's insane.
It does sound like a good deal. And I got to say, it's also really enticing. I'd like to see if I can swing that in my marriage.
It sounds like they're sick of winning in Britain.
You know what? This whole arrangement where I can see other women and I have no obligations, I'm just sick of. Because you demand periodic phone calls from me and we share an apartment. I'm leaving.
This is what happens when you win too much.
Get sick of it.
You've gotten sick of it.
We've literally
gotten
sick of
winning so much.
Of winning.
We've been winning. We're sick of it. We're done. Just bollocks. No more winning.
They're amazing. We even.
Going to lose now. It's going to be wonderful.
Just for a change
Although,
of pace.
You know, with that said, the only city that it sounds like, at least in the English-speaking world, that is more expensive to live in than New York sounds to be like London. Oh, yeah. Like, it just sounds like that's, I mean, as much as like New York has become sort of a freak show where it's like, let's go out and get a hamburger. Okay. Let me see if I can secure a loan. Let me see if I can go get, what kind of rates I'm going to get my dad to secure the purchase of a hamburger. He'll co-sign. Britain sounds like it's like that.
Yeah. London is.
Maybe I'm exaggerating.
No, London is incredibly expensive. Absolutely.
You're going to get so sick of winning. You've gotten so sick of winning that we're done.
Aren't we tired of it? I mean, I wrote it down. We're winning too much. It's exhausting.
All right, folks. We're going to take a quick break. It's the only way we'll stop doing these bad accents.
No, because we'll just do them in the fun half as well. So just take a pause now, and we'll see you shortly with more bad accents.
How can people call me? Like,
people
after
call you pretty
years,
regularly.
Like 5 years. Like, this is pretty, like, one great. Of my, this is an old friend of mine. He's actually been on the show. Like, doing the voice of Rupert Murdoch years ago.
Speaking of bad accents.
Right, no, not so great. But, I mean, how is it possible he thinks that he can call me now?
Noam Chomsky should know better than that.
Yeah, come on, Noam.
Maybe after a few years, people forget exactly what you do at certain times of the day.
Yeah, well, that sort of hurts. I mean... That sort of hurts. Like, is, yeah. All right.
Chomsky's always calling in to talk about Bob's Burgers. Well, yeah. It's like, you got a job to do.
Total Bob's Burgers.
Noam's like, where's Hugo?
Every day. Please leave a message of Hugo. All right. 646-257-3920 is the number. Folks, it is your membership that makes this show possible. Pennies a day. Pennies a day. And, day in, day out, we are here. Day in, day out. My God.
I say day in and day out.
Day in is in studio occasionally, yeah. And day out. Where else? Where? Tell me what other show that you listen to on a regular basis, or even ever. Are you? You're now going to be able to go out to your barbecue or whatever you're doing this weekend. And you're going to say to your friends, wow, this Brexit thing, crazy, right? And everybody's going to look at you like, what? And then you're going to start talking about it, and then people are just going to start shuffling away from you. But you're going to feel very good about yourself.
They're
going to
know at this point it's like Aikido. It's just like, okay, what was the Majority Report interview? Educate us. Thank you.
I don't know. My experience is just that I start talking to people, and people just sort of drift away. That's basically it. They just sort of drift away. And then I'm just
no comment.
No, I'm talking more. All right. But the point is, pennies a day, ladies and gentlemen. Why wouldn't you want to support this information that makes you alienated from all your friends? Join themajorityreport.com. Join themajorityreport.com. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. This is the way you win them back. This is the way you win them back. You alienate your friends with all the knowledge you learn on the show, and then you win them back by buying them coffee or offering them coffee. It's fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. And if you buy crap from Amazon, buy it through our link at majorityreportkickback.com. Have you never tried jet.com? Have you wanted to? Now's the time to do it. Now is the time to do it. It's fantastic. So much winning, you'll be sick. Go to majorityreportkickback.com, click on the jet.com link, and get sick. All right, we'll be right back.